In matter of Arnold Abramowitz, can we please have appearances of counsel? Now, Mr. Abramowitz, this is a recommendation of his barman, so you'll have the opportunity to address the court after your counsel if you'd like to, and you can consult right before then. Ms. Horton.
May it please the court, this matter is before the court following a presentment in three docketed matters. An 11-day ethics hearing was held before Special Ethics Master Judge Herbert S. Friend in fall of 2017. Judge Friend granted respondent's motion to consolidate the three dockets. Testimony was taken, and in October of 2018, this Special Ethics Master filed his report affirming all charges except dismissing the charge that the legal fees were shared with a non-lawyer. Thereafter, in August of 2019, the DRB filed a 58-page written opinion in which it parsed the record carefully and confirmed the charges found by the Special Ethics Master with the exception of six discrete RPC violations that it dismissed, one having previously been dismissed by Judge Friend, the charge that respondent shared fees with a non-lawyer. The DRB majority, which was six members in this case, voted to disbar respondent. The DRB minority, which in this case was three members, voted for a three-year suspension. It is fundamentally important that the court knows that real people were hurt by respondent's actions in this case. There is a pattern of respondent minimizing his conduct by saying things such as, Ms. Gonzalez didn't have a strong case. It wasn't of a high value. McLendon could only be compensated by the NJPLIGA, and his recovery would have been capped at $15,000. The tortfeasors were uninsured. It was challenging to prove McElden's residency. However, there was real injury to Ms. Gonzalez and to Mr. McLendon, and his resultant traumatic brain injury was life-altering and irreversible, and it was exacerbated by respondent's neglect, lack of diligence, his failure to communicate with Ms. Dixon, and his forgery of Ms. Gonzalez's signature. The intent of the ethics system is never to punish the attorney, but rather to protect the public, and the DRB rightly concluded that there is a high likelihood that respondent will repeat his actions. The DRB, looking at the same aggravating and mitigating factors as the court will, concluded that the aggravating factors far outweigh the mitigation. It considered primarily respondent's prior ethics history, his admonitions in 1995 for lack of diligence in pursuing an indigent client's criminal appeal, an admonition in 96 for failure to keep a personal injury client reasonably informed about the status of the matter, and an admonition in 97 for failure to cooperate with the DEC during its investigation in that matter. His reprimand in 2008 following, in that case, a default for lack of diligence, failure to communicate with clients, and failure to cooperate in the district investigation. His three-month suspension in 2009 following default for gross neglect of a real estate matter and for preparing a settlement statement that contained false information. And finally, his one-year suspension in 2015, also default, for misconduct involving the non-financial RPCs at play in the Gentry Henderson and Marie Benoit-led abatement matters. He has a documented lack of candor with disciplinary authorities. He's documented lack of cooperation with disciplinary authorities and demonstrated a lack of good judgment, character, and willingness to change his practices to conform to the rules of professional conduct. He also shows an apparent lack of remorse. The DRB determined that he is unsalvageable and that the public cannot be sufficiently protected by any discipline short of disbarment. The DRB examined the Morrell case, which is reported at 184 NJ 299 from 2005, where Morrell's client, a professional baseball player, retained Morrell to file a medical malpractice action for a botched back surgery. Morrell failed to file suit and lied to Morrell for years about the status of the case. Morrell eventually attained the client's approval for a fabricated $1.1 million settlement and obtained the client's signature on a phony release. The DRB voted to impose a two-year suspension, and the court ordered Morrell's disbarment. Turning back to the matter at hand, the OAE ultimately agrees with the decision of the DRB majority. Although it had originally recommended the salvaging of respondent's law license, it cannot argue that the DRB majority decided this case wrongly. Upon fuller reflection and attributing weight to the DRB's well-reasoned opinion, the OAE agrees that respondent's disciplinary history supports the board's conclusion that he is engaged in a pattern of unethical conduct sufficient to warrant disbarment, such as that in In re Zettler 182 NJ 389 from 2005 and In re Breen 113 NJ 522 from 1989, where disbarment for dishonest conduct on a continuing and ongoing basis, which would tarnish the legal profession and past similarity with past misconduct, resulted in disbarment. Obviously, this is an important case, and the OAE never takes lightly joining in on a recommendation that an attorney lose their license or making that recommendation in the first place. But when it considers harm to the unsuspecting clients who trusted respondent to help them, and his prior ethics history, his less than forthright conduct during the investigatory stage of these matters, it must join in the DRB's majority's solemn recommendation that respondent be disbarred. If the court determines that suspension is the more appropriate quantum of discipline, the OAE then, in the alternative, respectfully requests that this court consider its recommendations, as adopted also by the DRB minority, that respondent's return to practice is conditioned on court-ordered practice controls if the suspension rather than disbarment is imposed, including proof of psychological fitness to practice prior to any reinstatement, financial monitoring for 2 years, which would include submission of 3 reconciliations and supporting documentation for those reconciliations, and at least a 2-year proctorship for respondent. The OAE also respectfully requests that should suspension rather than disbarment be the ultimate decision of this court, that the 3-year prospective suspension recommended by the DRB minority be imposed rather than the 2 years recommended originally by Judge Friend in his report. If there's no further questions, I'll submit on the record established below.
Questions, anyone?
I have just 2, please. He has been suspended since 2015?
Yes,
never
sir.
Never reinstated?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's all. Ms. Warden, could you respond to one argument that we've heard from respondent, and that is that the press connectivity after he was suspended doesn't amount to unethical conduct? I know that's not the most serious of the charges here, but would you respond to that?
Yes, absolutely. One moment, if I may. Just gonna sure. Check the dates. So the practicing while suspended was based on 2 things. The one that you have alluded to, that was the trust account activity, the disbursements and deposits made after the effective date of his suspension, which was April 13th of 2015. But also on, and maybe this is an aside, so I won't spend time on it, but also that charge, the practicing while suspended, was also conditioned on his communications with Gonzalez in regards to the falsified settlement of her case that occurred after his effective date of his suspension in April 13th of 2015. He had her in
May. First
okay.
Example, the deposits and the disbursements. I think that's the argument that was raised.
Yes. So the disbursements were not made during the 30-day period between the suspension order, which was filed on March 12th, 2015, and the effective date of April 13th, 2015, but were made after that, in some cases several months after that, and in some cases sooner, including checks issued to the Cotton Funeral Home, the Brown overdraft that the Brown funds were distributed in June of 2015, debited and funded funds after that April 2015 effective date in Green Morris, Aldi, Innocent, Johnson, McClay, all of those cases where the funds came in and out. It has consistently been the position of the Office of Attorney Ethics that that dispersing funds after the date of the suspension is the unauthorized practice of law, and that is incumbent upon the responding attorney to carefully review Rule 1:20-20, consult with counsel if they have questions, or potentially even call the office or the investigator that worked, the financial investigator that worked their case to discuss whether such...
So if I understood you correctly, the short answer is the exception doesn't apply because there were disbursements after the 30-day period that followed the effective date of suspension?
Yes, that's part of it, yes.
Okay. Other questions, anyone?
No.
Thank you. Ms. Brown.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Ravner, and may it please the court. Excuse me. I think I'd like to begin with the contention that real people were hurt here. Clients are always have some problem that is larger than they can handle themselves, and that is what people, that's what lawyers are dealing with all the time. But specifically in the case of Ms. Gonzalez, yes, he did not serve and file a complaint in time, and the statute of limitations has run. In the Loring case and in a line of cases, there is a distinction between negligence, which is not an ethical violation, and gross negligence, which is the floor for an RPC 1.1 violation. And that has been charged here and been found here, but it's never been explained by anyone, by the OAE, or by the special master, or by the DRB, as to what is it about this case that the blowing of the deadline, if I may put it that way, what brings this case and that problem out of negligence and into gross negligence. So yes, real people were harmed here. It was, but I would submit to you, negligence, but I also submit to you what you have here is the deceitful way that Mr. Abramowitz went about making his client whole, because that's what he did here. This was a case where, from what he was informed by insurance company, the policy limit of the defendant who had hit his client was $50,000. He took the case on a contingency. When he dealt with her, he gave her from his own money, of course, as he had to. He didn't have malpractice insurance. He assumed her best case result, which would have been $50,000, and net the contingent fee and gave her that. It was an entirely wrong way to go about it, but what he attempted to do was to make his client whole. So he did harm, but he also tried to correct that harm. It's not the right way to do it, but it shows a person who cares about his client. It doesn't show an unsalvageable lawyer. I would also point out that he did that, when he did that and he held that closing, of course he should have told his client, I have made a mistake in your case. He had a failure of courage at that time. There was also a lot of stress at that time. When he did that, he did it late April of 2015, the suspension order of March 2015 was effective around April 13 of 2015. He did it after that date. We've acknowledged, he's admitted that was the unauthorized practice of law. He didn't want to, at that time, tell her the truth. He was also under a lot of other stress, candidly, and fear. I mean, even myself, when I represent clients in disciplinary matters and I get a case and I get a letter that says Supreme Court of New Jersey Office of Attorney Ethics, my stomach tightens. It was a period of fear. He had three matters going at the same time. That is, he had to comply with the suspension order. He had to fulfill his obligations with closing his practice. He had to do the affidavit of compliance. There was an ongoing investigation, the first of the three. He had to supply information with that. There was a lot of updating, continuing production obligations there, and he had bounced a check in late March. So there was not a period where he exercised good judgment. I would say we do ask a lot of lawyers, but it requires courage, and I would say this about courage, two things. First, it is the virtue that enables everything else. It enables candor. but it is also the virtue you cannot rely upon. That's what Murray Kempton said, and it's so true. And in that way, it doesn't make him an unsalvageable lawyer. It makes him a very human lawyer. Now, with respect to McClendon, that case is a very sad case. Mr. McClendon appeared at the hearing, as did his friend, who has, if she does nothing else on good on earth, she did tremendous good to Mr. McClendon. And Mr. McClendon was a passenger in a one-car accident. Nobody had insurance in the car. And then there was an issue under Pliga. His only recourse was through Pliga, but an essential element of the claim in Pliga is that you have to prove residency. And when Mr. McClendon and Miss Dixon first came to see Mr. Abramowitz, they gave him information that tended to support a residency with his mother who was uninsured. And that would prove a Pliga case, and he took the case. I think Ms. Horton mentioned that the case is worth the $15,000. That's what it was. But he took that case. It didn't matter as to what the value was for his time. And he handled that. But it was not a case that could be proved ultimately because he didn't, as a matter of fact, live with his mother at the time. And in addition, his mother would not swear in an affidavit that her son lived with her when he had not. That is the facts of McClendon, and as sad as that is, and as someone could be seriously injured because he had a brain injury, and as sad as that is, that the kind of remedies that would be available to him in the law were that limited, and with that residency requirement, when that case was dismissed with prejudice, justice was served. It was very rough justice. Nobody looks good. Mr. Abramowitz doesn't look good. He didn't timely serve discovery, and he didn't follow the rules regarding keeping the client involved when you have a motion to dismiss for a lack of discovery. But it is the case that it was the sound, just outcome. So there was, in a way, there was. He did not harm his clients by his practice. He took that case and he made the effort. It's also rather, I must say, as a practitioner, disturbing to me that the defense counsel's discovery abuse in that case, flagrant. I only put in a page or two of his discovery in the exhibits just to show there's a question with subparts, and I can't even think back when it was that we could allow, where you could make a discovery question with subparts. But he didn't comply with any rule regarding discovery. And this case was never about, and the fault in this case was never about, the discovery methodology was the pathway by which a result was reached in this case, but it was the sound result. But it was never about discovery. When it came time to for the final motion, the reconsideration motion, because this was an attorney who kept bringing these motions, he had discovery. And the judge knew he had discovery. This was not about the way the discovery was answered. It was about brought to light through this discovery and an inability to answer a discovery question relating to residence that he had no facts to support it at that time. That is why the judge ruled the way he did. First of all, it's a shortcut. Maybe it should have technically been a summary judgment motion with showing an absence of proof, and then you would have gotten an order that way. But what the judge realized was there was an absence of proof. He dismissed the case at that time with prejudice, but with a very indulgent standard for reinstatement that doesn't exist in the rules. And that's why he did it. He didn't do it, you know, to answer the Form A rocks. So this case took a very unusual course, but came to the sound, just result. And in that way, two things I don't see, and no one ever explains, how this case is an RPC 1.1 violation when on the merits the case could not be proved. But I think it also shows that he did not harm his client. He tried to make his clients whole, but his client did not have a remedy as a matter of law. Now, with respect to whether he was told about it, I would submit to you, and I have briefed that, because that's another charge, a communication charge, that's made against him in the McClendon matter. He says he did, and Ms. Dixon says she didn't. I would say the facts there are in equipoise and don't meet the standard of proof. Mr. Abramowitz had an inner city clientele in Irvington, New Jersey, downtown Irvington, New Jersey. That client base doesn't view getting things in the mail the same way as the rest of us may. But be that as it may, he did not send these documents in the mail the way he should. He didn't comply with the rule. But he did tell them, and I'd say the facts are in equipoise on that, and that there is no proof of the RPC 1.3 violation. I would also say to you that while the OAE in its complaint, and a lot of negative innuendo in that complaint, paints a very negative picture of Mr. Abramowitz, and I sometimes ask myself, what negative stereotype of a personal injury attorney isn't in that complaint? But if you look at the way his clientele treated him, you will see that he, as I say, he had a long-term practice in downtown Irvington. He was a two-man firm. It was the largest firm in Irvington at the time. He received a Chamber of Commerce award from the Irvington Chamber of Commerce. That shows he was integrated in that community over a long period of time. So the picture down on the ground from the community itself is one of respect and regard for Mr. Abramowitz. Now, Mr. Abramowitz, while I think a capable lawyer, and a capable lawyer who cared for his client. There's evidence in the record that he would perform incidental legal services for them for free. For example, a power of attorney was prepared for Mr. McClendon by Mr. Abramowitz for free. In the testimony concerning Mrs. Gonzalez, after she was injured, she had a fractured leg. He visited her at her home because she could not travel to his office. He would do things like that for his clients. So this would be someone who tried to help his clients and cared about his clients and is not an indifferent lawyer as portrayed by the Office of Attorney Ethics. So I think that's one of the problems in this case. The problem is that there is, I would say, submit to you a jaundiced view of Mr. Abramowitz that is not borne out by the true facts. I think that, however, he has made serious mistakes, and he has disrespected this court, which I think is the main. I just do think it's the main thing that gives pause is the disciplinary history, the six charges, with the three or four successive defaults, because he did not respond to the Office of Attorney Ethics. And in that way, he has disrespected the court. He should not have done. He has disrespected the court's obligations with respect to oversight. He does, and in that, the only thing you can say is that he's a foolish man. He's a foolhardy man who put his very license on the line by this avoiding. You know, he was in a busy practice, personal injury practices, very busy, and if you wanted to get a sort of snapshot of his practice, you could just look at the affidavit of compliance that he submitted for the number of cases that he had at the time. But I'm just saying that because he tended to be avoidant, and Dr. Kieran Ayer testified about that, he always, in a busy practice, had something to do, so it was rather easy to avoid, but he should not have done. I will say to you, I think that the way he handled this case shows that he's broken that practice. I think he hit bottom, if you will, with respect to avoiding, and he recognized what was on the line and what was important to him, and his license was important to him, and he retained counsel. Better if we had retained counsel earlier, but he has done. He has admitted his faults here, including things that the OAE did not see with respect to the false information that he gave to them when they asked for the Gonzalez file. And what had happened there was he had staged the closing. He wanted his client to think, I've gotten this result for you, and he made her whole. Again, wrong way to go about it, made him look good before his client, but he did make her whole. He deposited those monies into his trust account at or about the time, I think, of the closing. It was sometime in April. And then I think he and disposed them sometime after. But then when the OAE, some 8 or 9 months later, asked for the Gonzalez file, he realized, well, I would need, if I've deposited the monies in April, in a personal injury case, the way it goes is you settle a case, you do the closing papers, you send them to defense counsel, a couple of weeks go by, you get the money, the plaintiff's attorney gets the money and you put it in. So he's saying, if I put this in on April 24th, then I need to show a closing date in March, and that's why he did it. And he was, at that point, again, not good judgment, under a lot of stress, concerned about his future, already under suspension for 9 months, and he did a wrong thing. But I think if you look at that, especially if you look at those false ones that he says, they certainly were not designed to, let me just say, on his behalf, he's not very good at being deceitful, because if you look at the settlement papers that were the false ones, it says, you know, it shows a closing date of March 10, and he does the settlement, and it says, you know, costs waived, fees waived. That just doesn't make any sense. And it's not anything that wouldn't have raised questions with the Office of Attorney Ethics. So it doesn't show, it shows deceit, but it doesn't show deceit out of a habit of deceit. It shows maybe out of a stress of the time and a fear and a shame and all of those things where you do something that that you shouldn't do. But it doesn't show a deceitful man. It doesn't show someone's character so unsalvageable that they cannot act in a representative capacity on behalf of someone else.
May I ask you a question on that score? Mm-hmm. You've touched upon your client's lengthy history of ethical lapses that span 2 decades. We have the egregious conduct in the Gonzalez matter that you've referred to. What should afford this court confidence that if your client were permitted to practice again, there would not be additional ethical lapses, there would not be harm to the public?
Well, I think there's a couple. First of all, as I say, the turnaround has already happened because he handled this case differently. He was off to a slow start in this case. I think it's about 54 days. But thereafter, you know, he was compliant. So that's the first thing. He recognizes he can't do that anymore. The second thing is, and it's in the papers, it's at 148, Dr. Ayer had suggested he receive CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, to determine, you know, to learn to address your avoidance, your way of dealing with the problem by avoiding it. And he has done that. The third thing is, you know, just as a practical matter here, we're not talking about a lawyer in the early stages of his career. You're talking about a lawyer who was practicing 39 years in 2015 when he was suspended. So it's not something that you have a long term. And, you know, candidly, he's been away from the practice of law for 5 years. But it matters to him and his identity, as I think is normal for any lawyer, because it's not easy to be a lawyer. And what you use, your skills are drawn from you yourself, so there is a meld between you, the practitioner, and you, the person, and it's an identity. And he would not like to lose that identity. But I think, you know, all of those things that he's gotten the training, but mostly because he's at this point in his life where the real question is, I think, not how do we know this won't happen again, but why? Why should that be taken from him after 39 years? Why should his self-respect and self-identity be taken? I would submit to you on the merits, the wrong is not good. And he made his bed. I think I want you to understand that. He created this situation that he's in. He made his bed. But I do not believe, as serious as it is, that it merits disbarment. And I think, and it certainly doesn't merit, after all these decades of practice, by his best lights, that it merits being sort of branded as unsalvageable. Because what makes a lawyer, again, as I've said, is yourself, you know, you applying your learning, but also your own abilities and that come from you, that create a lawyer. So, you know, that's a particularly harsh brand to place on someone. There may be people who deserve it. But I don't believe that Mr. Abramowitz is in that category.
I know you had asked for 20 minutes, which we've now passed. Is there anything else you'd like to present?
I just want to say very briefly about the remedy. I think, of course, it should be not disbarment. I recognize that this is serious. I had originally asked for 2 years, running from the time of 2016 when the initial suspendant ended. How you deal with that, I recognize it's a serious suspension situation that he is in. If the court would take some consideration of the time that has elapsed where he has not been able to earn, I would appreciate that. I do also want to say I do not quite understand the OAE's request that there be some psychological fitness requirement, because there's nothing in the hearing itself that warrants that charge. It was Dr. Ayer saying he's avoidant, he needs this therapy, he received this therapy. What more would be done? What more would he do to fulfill this based on what was before us in the hearing? The second thing is with respect to a proctor. I don't believe a proctor is what's needed. He knows how to do he knows his lane and he does it well. The thought that there should be, if he opens a trust account, that there should be some oversight or some kind of proof that he's maintaining the trust account in a proper way or using an accounting seems perfectly reasonable under these circumstances. And with that, unless the court has any questions, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Does Mr. Abramowitz want to address the court, and would you like to speak?
May I have a moment?
Yeah.
Arnold Abramowitz appearing before you. Good afternoon. I just want to say very briefly, I'm sorry that my actions have brought us all here, and I'm sorry that my actions brought disrespect to the law. From my childhood, I wanted to be an attorney. I loved going to law school, and I loved the practice of law. I had a very close relationship with my clients. As counsel said, I have been in Irvington I practiced 39 years, been in Irvington probably for about 36. And I provided, a special kind of representation in Irvington. Most of my clients are not very sophisticated. I would spend a significant portion each week doing what I would sort of consider pro bono work. I would do a lot of free work because they had no way to get answers on how the law worked. I would give them lots and lots of free legal advice so they could maybe go to court in small claims court by themselves. I would go to small claims court occasionally for free. But of course, I couldn't maintain that very often. I was an arbitrator at Essex County Courts for 10 years in the personal injury arbitration, and did lots of pro bono work for the Township of Irvington in their court system. I understand and take full responsibility for, you know, everything in my past, and I'm horrified, you know, by when you look at it all in lump sum. And it will never happen again if you give me the opportunity to continue being an attorney. I love being a lawyer. I just wanted you to know that, and I apologize to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Court is in recess. We'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you.